5. Viola Philippi, the wife of the one-time auto parts tycoon of Louisiana, was something of an expert on motivation herself before she and Robert flew to South America. She had been born with albinism. Her body did not produce the enzyme tyrosinase, critical in the production of melanin, and as a result, her skin, hair, and eyes contained no pigment, and her eyesight was poor. She was legally blind and could read only by putting her face very close to a page and using a magnifying glass. "You have never met a more determined person, though," her daughter Roxanne told me. "She could do anything." When Viola was a girl, the school district had tried to put her into remedial classes, despite the fact that it was her eyes, not her brain, that had problems. But she refused to leave the classroom where her friends sat. She stayed in that room until administrators relented. After she graduated, she went to Louisiana State University and told the school she expected them to provide someone to read textbooks to her aloud. The school complied. During her sophomore year, she met Robert, who soon dropped out to start washing and greasing cars for a local Ford dealer. He encouraged her to quit school as well. She politely declined and got her degree. They were married in December 1950, 4 months after she graduated. They had 6 children in rapid succession, and while Robert built his empire, Viola ran the household. There were morning meetings and charts showing what each child had to accomplish each day. There were Friday night check-ins, during which everyone laid out their goals for the coming week. "They were like 2 peas in a pod, both totally driven," said Roxanne. Mom refused to let her disabilities stop her. I think that's why it was so hard for her when Dad changed. When Robert's apathy took hold, Viola initially focused her energy on caring for him. She hired nurses to help him exercise and worked with his brother to form a committee to oversee and then sell off Robert's companies. After a while, however, she ran out of things to do. She had married a bon vivant, a man so full of life that it was hard to go to the grocery store because he constantly stopped to chat with everyone. Now Robert sat in a chair in front of the television all day. Viola was miserable. "He didn't speak to me," she told the courtroom when the family sued for insurance money they felt owed because of Robert's neurological injuries. It didn't seem like he was interested in anything I did. You know, I would fix his meals and I was more or less a caretaker. I guess you would call me a caretaker." For a few years, she felt sorry for herself. Then she became angry. Then busy. If Robert wasn't going to show any motivation to reclaim his life, then she would force him to get moving again. She would make him engage. She began by asking him ceaseless questions. When she made lunch, she would pepper him with choices: sandwich or soup, lettuce or tomato, ham or turkey. What about mayonnaise? Ice water or juice? She didn't really mean anything by it at first. She was just frustrated and wanted to make him speak. But then, after a few months of harassing him, Viola found that whenever Robert was pressured into making decisions, he seemed to come out of his shell a little bit. He would banter with her for a few moments or tell her about a program he had been watching. One night, after she had forced him to make a dozen choices about what he was going to eat and which table they should sit at and what music to listen to, he began talking at length, reminding her of a funny story from after they had gotten married, when they had locked themselves out of the house in a rainstorm. He told the story in an offhand way and chuckled as he recalled trying to jimmy a window. It was the first time Viola had heard him laugh in years. For a few minutes, it was like the old Robert was back. Then he faced the TV and went silent again. Viola continued her campaign, and over time, more and more of the old Robert emerged. Viola congratulated, cajoled, and rewarded him whenever he seemed, for a moment, like his former self. When he went back to Dr. Stroob, the neurologist in New Orleans, for his annual checkup 7 years after the trip to South America, the doctor could see the difference. He was saying hello to the nurses and asking them about their kids, Dr. Stroob said. He would initiate conversations with me, ask about my hobbies. He had opinions on the routes they should drive to get home. It was stuff you wouldn't have noticed with anyone else, but with him, it was like someone was turning on the lights again. As neurologists have studied how motivation functions within our brains, they've become increasingly convinced that people like Robert don't lose their drive because they've lost the capacity for self-motivation. Rather, their apathy is due to an emotional dysfunction. One of the things Habib, the French researcher, noticed about all the people he studied was that they shared an odd emotional detachment. One apathetic woman told him she had hardly reacted when her father died. A man said he hadn't felt the urge to hug his wife or children since the passivity had taken hold. When Habib asked patients if they felt sad about how much their lives had changed, they all said no. They didn't feel anything. Neurologists have suggested that this emotional numbness is why some people feel no motivation. Among Habib's patients, the injuries in their striata prevented them from feeling the sense of reward that comes from taking control. Their motivation went dormant because they had forgotten how good it feels to make a choice. In other situations, it's that people have never learned what it feels like to be self-determined because they have grown up in a neighborhood that seems to offer so few choices, or they have forgotten the rewards of autonomy since they've moved into a nursing home. This theory suggests how we can help ourselves and others strengthen our internal locus of control. We should reward initiative, congratulate people for self-motivation, celebrate when an infant wants to feed herself. We should applaud a child who shows defiant, self-righteous stubbornness and reward a student who finds a way to get things done by working around the rules. This is easier in theory, of course, than practice. We all applaud self-motivation until a toddler won't put on his shoes, an aged parent is ripping a dresser out of the wall, or a teenager ignores the rules. But that's how an internal locus of control becomes stronger. That's how our mind learns and remembers how good it feels to be in control. And unless we practice self-determination and give ourselves emotional rewards for subversive assertiveness, our capacity for self-motivation can fade. What's more, we need to prove to ourselves that our choices are meaningful. When we start a new task or confront an unpleasant chore, we should take a moment to ask ourselves why. Why are we forcing ourselves to climb up this hill? Why are we pushing ourselves to walk away from the television? Why is it so important to return that email or deal with a coworker whose requests seem so unimportant? Once we start asking why, those small tasks become pieces of a larger constellation of meaningful projects, goals, and values. We start to recognize how small chores can have outsized emotional rewards, because they prove to ourselves that we are making meaningful choices, that we are genuinely in control of our own lives. That's when self-motivation flourishes. When we realize that replying to an email or helping a coworker on its own might be relatively unimportant, but it is part of a bigger project that we believe in, that we want to achieve, that we have chosen to do. Self-motivation, in other words, is a choice we make because it is part of something bigger and more emotionally rewarding than the immediate task that needs doing. In 2010, 22 years after her South American vacation with Robert, Viola was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. It took 2 years for the disease to consume her. At every step, Robert was there, helping her out of bed in the morning and reminding her to take her medications at night. He asked her questions to distract her from the pain and fed her when she became feeble. When Viola finally passed, Robert sat by her empty bed for days. His children, worried he was slipping back into apathy, suggested another visit with a neurologist in New Orleans. Perhaps the doctor would recommend something to forestall his listlessness from returning. "No," Robert replied. "It wasn't apathy keeping him indoors. He just needed some time to reflect on 62 years of marriage." Viola had helped Robert build a life. And then, when everything had slipped from his grasp, she helped him rebuild it again. He just wanted to honor that by pausing for a few days, he told his kids. A week later, he left the house and came over for brunch. Afterward, he babysat his grandchildren. Robert passed away 24 months later, in 2014. He was active, his obituary noted, until the end. Chapter 2. Teams. Psychological safety at Google and Saturday Night Live. Julia Rozovsky was 25 years old and uncertain what to do with her life when she decided it was time for a change. She was a Tufts graduate with a bachelor's degree in math and economics who had previously worked at a consulting firm, which she found unfulfilling. Then she had become a researcher for two professors at Harvard, which was fun, but not a long-term career. Maybe, she thought, she belonged in a big corporation. Or perhaps she ought to become an academic. Or maybe she should join a tech startup. It was all very confusing to her. So she picked the option that meant she didn't have to decide. She applied to business schools and was accepted to start at the Yale School of Management in 2010. She showed up in New Haven ready to bond with her classmates and, like all new students, was assigned to a study group. This group, she figured, would be an important part of her education. They would become close friends and learn together, debate important issues, and discover, with each other's help, who they were meant to be. Study groups are a rite of passage at most MBA programs, a way for students to practice working in teams. At Yale, each study group shares the same class schedule and collaborates on each group assignment, one of the school's websites explained. Study groups have been carefully constructed to bring together students with diverse backgrounds, both professionally and culturally. Each day during lunch or after dinner, Julia and the four other members of her study group would gather to discuss homework and compare spreadsheets, strategize for upcoming exams, and trade lecture notes. Truth be told, her group wasn't all that diverse. Two of them had been management consultants like Julia. Another had worked at a startup. They were all smart and curious and outgoing. Their similarity, she hoped, would make it easy for them to bond. "There are lots of people who say some of their best business school friends come from their study groups," said Julia. "But it wasn't like that for me." Almost from the start, study group felt like a daily dose of stress. "I never felt completely relaxed," she told me. "I always felt like I had to prove myself." Dynamics quickly emerged that put her on edge. Everyone wanted to show they were leaders. And so when teachers issued study group assignments, there were subtle tussles over who was in charge. People would try to show authority by speaking louder or talking over each other, Julia said. When it came to divvying up tasks for projects, One group member would sometimes preemptively assign roles, and then the others would critique those assignments, and then someone else would claim authority over some part of the project, and then everyone else would rush to grab their own piece. Maybe it was my own insecurities, but I always felt like I had to be careful not to make mistakes around them, said Julia. People were critical of each other, but they would play it off like they were making a joke, and so the group was kind of passive-aggressive. I was looking forward to making friends with my group, she said. It really bummed me out that we didn't gel. So Julia started looking for other groups to join, other ways to connect with classmates. One person mentioned that some students were putting together a team to participate in case competitions, in which business school students proposed innovative solutions to real-world business problems. Teams would receive a case study, spend a few weeks writing a business plan, and then submit it to high-profile executives and professors who picked the winner. Companies sponsored these contests, and there were cash prizes, as well as, sometimes, jobs that came out of the competitions. Julia signed up. Yale hosted about a dozen different case competition teams. The one Julia joined included a former Army officer, a think tank researcher, the director of a health education nonprofit, and a refugee program manager. Unlike her study group, everyone was from different backgrounds. From the start, though, they all clicked. Each time a new case arrived, the team would gather in the library and dive into action, spending hours brainstorming options, assigning research duties, and divvying up writing assignments. Then they would meet again and again and again. One of the best cases we did was about Yale itself, Julia said. There had always been a student-run snack store, but the university was taking over food sales, and so the business school sponsored a contest to overhaul the shop. We met every night for a week. I thought we should fill the shop with nap pods, and someone else said it should become a game room. And there was also some kind of clothing swap idea. We had lots of crazy ideas. No one ever shot down a suggestion, not even the nap pods. Julia's study group, as part of their class assignments, had also engaged in a fair amount of brainstorming. But if I had ever mentioned something like a nap pod, somebody would have rolled their eyes and come up with 15 reasons why it was a dumb idea. And it was a dumb idea. But my case team loved it. We always loved each other's dumb ideas. We spent an hour figuring out how nap pods could make money by selling accessories like earplugs. Eventually, Julia's case team settled on the idea of converting the student shop into a micro gym with a handful of exercise classes and a few workout machines. They spent weeks researching pricing models and contacting equipment manufacturers. They won the competition, and the micro gym exists today. That same year, Julia's case team spent another month studying ways for a chain of eco-friendly convenience stores to expand into North Carolina. We must have analyzed 24 plans, she said. A lot of them turned out not to make any sense. When the team traveled to Portland, Oregon to present their final suggestion, a slow-growth approach that emphasized the chain's healthy food options, they placed first in the nation. Julia's study group dissolved sometime in her second semester after one person and then another and then everyone stopped showing up. The case competition team grew as new students asked if they could join. The core group of five teammates, including Julia, remained involved the entire time they were at Yale. Today, these people are some of her closest friends. They attend one another's weddings and visit each other when traveling. They call each other for career advice and pass along job leads. It always struck Julia as odd that those two teams felt so different. Her study group felt stressful because everyone was always jousting for leadership and critiquing each other's ideas. Her case competition team felt exciting because everyone was so supportive and enthusiastic. Both groups, however, were composed of basically the same kinds of people. They were all bright, and everyone was friendly outside of the team settings. There was no reason why the dynamic inside Julia's study group needed to become so competitive, while the culture of the case team was so easygoing. I couldn't figure out why things had turned out so different, Julia told me. It didn't seem like it had to happen that way. After graduation, Julia went to work at Google and joined its People Analytics group, which was tasked with studying nearly every aspect of how employees spent their time. What she was supposed to do with her life, it turned out, was use data to figure out why people behave in certain ways. For 6 years running, Google had been ranked by Fortune as one of America's top workplaces. The company's executives believed that was because, even as it had grown to 53,000 employees, Google had devoted enormous resources to studying workers' happiness and productivity. The People Analytics Group, part of Google's Human Resources Division, helped examine if employees were satisfied with their bosses and coworkers, whether they felt overworked, intellectually challenged, and fairly paid, whether their work-life balance was actually balancing out, as well as hundreds of other variables. The division helped with hiring and firing decisions, and its analysts provided insights into who should be promoted and who, perhaps, had risen too fast. In the years before Julia joined the group, People Analytics had determined that Google needed to interview a job applicant only 4 times to predict, with 86% confidence, if they would be a good hire. The division had successfully pushed to increase paid maternity leave from 12 to 18 weeks because computer models indicated that would reduce the frequency of new mothers quitting by 50%. At the most basic level, the division's goal was to make life at Google a little bit better and a lot more productive. With enough data, People Analytics believed, almost any behavioral puzzle could be solved. People Analytics' biggest undertaking in recent years had been a study, codenamed Project Oxygen before it was revealed, that examined why some managers were more effective than others. Ultimately, researchers had identified 8 critical management skills. Project Oxygen found that a good manager, 1, is a good coach, 2, empowers and does not micromanage, 3, expresses interest and concern in subordinates' success and well-being, 4, is results-oriented, 5, listens and shares information, 6, helps with career development, 7, has a clear vision and strategy, 8, has key technical skills. Oxygen was a huge success for us, said Abir Dubey, a People Analytics manager. It helped clarify what differentiated good managers from everyone else and how we could help people improve. The project was so useful, in fact, that at about the same time Julia was hired, Google began another massive effort, this one codenamed Project Aristotle. Dubey and his colleagues had noticed that many Google employees, in company surveys, had consistently mentioned the importance of their teams. Googlers would say things like, "I have a great manager, but my team has never clicked," or, "My manager isn't fantastic, but the team is so strong it doesn't matter," said Dubey. And that was kind of eye-opening, because Project Oxygen had looked at leadership, but it hadn't focused on how teams function, or if there's an optimal mix of different kinds of people or backgrounds. Dubey and his colleagues wanted to figure out how to build the perfect team. Julia became one of the effort's researchers. The project started with a sweeping review of academic literature. Some scientists had found that teams function best when they contained a concentration of people with similar levels of extroversion and introversion, while others had found that a balance of personalities was key. There were studies about the importance of teammates having similar tastes and hobbies, and others lauding diversity within groups. Some research suggested that teams needed people who liked to collaborate. Others said groups were more successful when individuals had healthy rivalries. The literature, in other words, was all over the place. So Project Aristotle spent more than 150 hours asking Google employees what they thought made a team effective. "We learned that teams are somewhat in the eye of the beholder," said Dubay. "One group might appear like it's working really well from the outside, but inside, everyone is miserable." Eventually, they established criteria for measuring teams' effectiveness based on external factors, such as whether a group hit their sales targets, as well as internal variables, such as how productive team members felt. Then the Aristotle group began measuring everything they could. Researchers examined how often teammates socialized outside of work and how members divided up tasks. They drew complicated diagrams to show teams overlapping memberships and then compared those against statistics of which groups had exceeded their department's goals. They studied how long teams stuck together and if gender balance had an impact on effectiveness. No matter how they arranged the data, though, it was almost impossible to find patterns or any evidence that a team's composition was correlated with its success. "We looked at 180 teams from all over the company," said Dubay. "We had lots of data, but there was nothing showing that a mix of specific personality types or skills or backgrounds made any difference. The who part of the equation didn't seem to matter." Some productive Google teams, for instance, were composed of friends who played sports together outside of work. Others were made up of people who were basically strangers away from the conference room. Some groups preferred strong managers. Others wanted a flatter structure. Most confounding of all, sometimes two teams would have nearly identical compositions with overlapping memberships, but radically different levels of effectiveness. "At Google, we're good at finding patterns," said Dubay. "There weren't strong patterns here." So Project Aristotle turned to a different approach. There was a second body of academic research that focused on what are known as group norms. Any group, over time, develops collective norms about appropriate behavior, a team of psychologists had written in the Sociology of Sport journal. Norms are the traditions, behavioral standards, and unwritten rules that govern how we function. When a team comes to an unspoken consensus that avoiding disagreement is more valuable than debate, that's a norm asserting itself. If a team develops a culture that encourages differences of opinion and spurns groupthink, that's another norm holding sway. Team members might behave certain ways as individuals. They may chafe against authority or prefer working independently. But often, inside a group, there's a set of norms that override those preferences and encourage deference to the team. The Project Aristotle researchers went back to their data and analyzed it again, this time looking for norms. They found that some teams consistently allowed people to interrupt one another. Others enforced taking conversational turns. Some teams celebrated birthdays and began each meeting with a few minutes of informal chit-chat. Others got right to business. There were teams that contained extroverts who hewed to the group's sedate norms whenever they assembled, and others where introverts came out of their shells as soon as meetings began. And some norms, the data indicated, consistently correlated with high team effectiveness. One engineer, for instance, told the researchers that his team leader is direct and straightforward, which creates a safe space for you to take risks. She also takes the time to ask how we are, figure out how she can help you and support you. That was one of the most effective groups inside Google. Alternately, another engineer told the researchers that his team leader has poor emotional control. He panics over small issues and keeps trying to grab control. I would hate to be driving with him in the passenger seat, because he would keep trying to grab the steering wheel and crash the car. That team did not perform well. Most of all, though, employees talked about how various teams felt. And that made a lot of sense to me, maybe because of my experiences at Yale, Julia said. I'd been on some teams that left me feeling totally exhausted, and others where I got so much energy from the group. There is strong evidence that group norms play a critical role in shaping the emotional experience of participating in a team. Research by psychologists from Yale, Harvard, Berkeley, the University of Oregon, and elsewhere indicate that norms determine whether we feel safe or threatened, enervated or excited, and motivated or discouraged by our teammates. Julia's study group at Yale, for instance, felt draining because the norms, the tussles over leadership, the pressure to constantly demonstrate expertise, the tendency to critique, had put her on guard. In contrast, the norms of her case competition team, enthusiasm for one another's ideas, withholding criticisms, encouraging people to take a leadership role or hang back as they wanted, allowed everyone to be friendly and unconstrained. Coordination was easy. Group norms, the researchers on Project Aristotle concluded, were the answer to improving Google's teams. The data finally started making sense, said Dubay. We had to manage the how of teams, not the who. The question, however, was which norms mattered most. Google's research had identified dozens of norms that seemed important, and sometimes the norms of one effective team contradicted the norms of another equally successful group. Was it better to let everyone speak as much as they wanted? Or should strong leaders end meandering debates? Was it more effective for people to openly disagree with one another? Or should conflicts be downplayed? Which norms were most crucial? 2. In 1991, a first-year PhD student named Amy Edmondson began visiting hospital wards, intending to show that good teamwork and good medicine went hand in hand. But the data kept saying she was wrong. Edmondson was studying organizational behavior at Harvard. A professor had asked her to help with a study of medical mistakes, and so Edmondson, on the prowl for a dissertation topic, started visiting recovery rooms, talking to nurses, and paging through error reports from two Boston hospitals. In one cardiac ward, she discovered that a nurse had accidentally given a patient an IV of lidocaine, an anesthetic, rather than heparin, a blood thinner. In an orthopedic ward, a patient was given amphetamines rather than aspirin. You would be shocked at how many mistakes occur every day, Edmondson told me. Not because of incompetence, but because hospitals are really complicated places, and there's usually a large team, as many as 24 nurses and techs and doctors, who might be involved in each patient's care. That's a lot of opportunities for something to slip through the cracks. Some parts of the hospitals Edmondson visited seemed more accident-prone than others. The orthopedic ward, for instance, reported an average of one error every 3 weeks. The cardiac ward, on the other hand, reported a mistake almost every other day. Edmondson also found that the various departments had very different cultures. In the cardiac ward, nurses were chatty and informal. They gossiped in the hallways and had pictures of their kids on the walls. In orthopedics, people were more sedate. Nurse managers wore business suits rather than scrubs and asked everyone to keep the public areas free of personal items and clutter. Perhaps, Edmondson thought, she could study the various teams' cultures and see if they correlated with error rates. She and a colleague created a survey to measure team cohesion on various wards. She asked nurses to describe how frequently their team leaders set clear goals and whether teammates discussed conflicts openly or avoided tense conversations. She measured the satisfaction, happiness, and self-motivation of different groups and hired a research assistant to observe the wards for 2 months. "I figured it would be pretty straightforward," Edmondson told me. "The units with the strongest sense of teamwork would have the lowest error rates." Except, when she tabulated her data, Edmondson found exactly the opposite. The wards with the strongest team cohesion had far more errors. She checked the data again. It didn't make any sense. Why would strong teams make more mistakes? Confused, Edmondson decided to look at these nurses' responses, question by question, alongside the error rates to see if any explanations emerged. Edmondson had included one survey question that inquired specifically about the personal risks associated with making errors. She asked people to agree or disagree with the statement, "If you make a mistake in this unit, it is held against you." Once she compared the data from that question with error incidents, she realized what was going on. It wasn't that wards with strong teams were making more mistakes. Rather, it was that nurses who belonged to strong teams felt more comfortable reporting their mistakes. The data indicated that one particular norm, whether people were punished for missteps, influenced if they were honest after they screwed up. Some leaders have established a climate of openness that facilitates discussion of error, which is likely to be an important influence on detected error rates, Edmondson wrote in the Journal of Applied Behavioral Science in 1996. What particularly surprised her, however, was how complicated things got the closer she looked. It wasn't simply that strong teams encouraged open communication and weak teams discouraged it. In fact, while some strong teams emboldened people to admit their mistakes, other, equally strong teams made it hard for nurses to speak up. What made the difference wasn't team cohesion. Rather, it was the culture each team established. In one ward with a strong team, for instance, nurses were overseen by a hands-on manager who actively invites questions and concerns. In an interview, the nurse manager explains that a certain level of error will occur, so a non-punitive environment is essential to deal with this error productively, Edmondson wrote. "There is an unspoken rule here to help each other and check each other," a nurse told Edmondson's assistant. "People feel more willing to admit to errors here because the nurse manager goes to bat for you." In another ward with a team that, at first glance, seemed equally strong, a nurse said that when she admitted hurting a patient while drawing blood, the nurse manager made her feel like she was on trial. Another said doctors bite your head off if you make a mistake. Yet measurements of group cohesion on this ward were still very high. A nurse told the research assistant that the ward prides itself on being clean, neat, and having an appearance of professionalism. The nurse manager for the ward dressed in business suits, and when she delivered criticism, she considerately offered her critiques behind closed doors. The staff said they appreciated the manager's professionalism, were proud of their department, and felt a strong sense of unity. To Edmondson, the team seemed like they genuinely liked and respected one another. But they also admitted that the unit's culture sometimes made it hard to confess making a mistake. It wasn't the strength of the team that determined how many errors were reported. Rather, it was one specific norm. When Edmondson started working on her dissertation, she visited technology companies and factory floors and asked people about the unwritten rules that shaped how their teammates behaved. People would say things like, "This is one of the best teams I've ever been on because I don't have to wear a work face here," or, "We aren't afraid to share crazy ideas," Edmondson told me. On those teams, norms of enthusiasm and support had taken hold, and everyone felt empowered to voice opinions and take risks. And other teams would tell me, "My group is really dedicated to each other, and so I try not to go outside my department without checking with my supervisor first." Or, "We're all in this together, so I don't like to bring up an idea unless I know it will work." Within those teams, a norm of loyalty held sway, and it undermined people's willingness to make suggestions or take chances. Both enthusiasm and loyalty are admirable norms. It wasn't clear to managers that they would have such different impacts on people's behaviors. And yet they did. In that setting, enthusiastic norms made teams better. Loyalty norms made them less effective. "Managers never intend to create unhealthy norms," Edmondson said. "Sometimes, though, they make choices that seem logical, like encouraging people to flesh out their ideas before presenting them, that ultimately undermine a team's ability to work together." As her research continued, Edmondson found a handful of good norms that seemed to be consistently associated with higher productivity. On the best teams, for instance, leaders encouraged people to speak up. Teammates felt like they could expose their vulnerabilities to one another. People said they could suggest ideas without fear of retribution. The culture discouraged people from making harsh judgments. As Edmondson's list of good norms grew, she began to notice that everything shared a common attribute. They were all behaviors that created a sense of togetherness while also encouraging people to take a chance. "We call it psychological safety," she said. Psychological safety is a shared belief held by members of a team that the group is a safe place for taking risks. It is a sense of confidence that the team will not embarrass, reject, or punish someone for speaking up, Edmondson wrote in a 1999 paper. It describes a team climate characterized by interpersonal trust and mutual respect in which people are comfortable being themselves. Julia and her Google colleagues found Edmondson's papers as they were researching norms. The idea of psychological safety, they felt, captured everything their data indicated was important to Google's teams. The norms that Google's surveys said were most effective, allowing others to fail without repercussions, respecting divergent opinions, feeling free to question others' choices, but also trusting that people aren't trying to undermine you, were all aspects of feeling psychologically safe at work. It was clear to us that this idea of psychological safety was pointing to which norms were most important, said Julia. But it wasn't clear how to teach those inside Google. People here are really busy. We needed clear guidelines for creating psychological safety without losing the capacity for dissent and debate that's critical to how Google functions. In other words, how do you convince people to feel safe while also encouraging them to be willing to disagree? For a long time, that was the million-dollar question, Edmondson told me. We knew it was important for teammates to be open with each other. We knew it was important for people to feel like they can speak up if something's wrong. But those are also the behaviors that can set people at odds. We didn't know why some groups could clash and still have psychological safety, while others would hit a period of conflict and everything would fall apart. 3. On the first day of auditions for the television show that became known as Saturday Night Live, the actors showed up, one after another, hour after hour, until it felt like it would never stop. There were two women who played Midwestern housewives preparing for the annual meteorological disaster. "Can I borrow your centerpiece for the tornado this year?" And a singer with an original composition named "I Am Dog," lampooning the women's liberation anthem, "I Am Woman." A roller skating impressionist and an obscure musician named Meatloaf took the stage around lunchtime. The actor Morgan Freeman and the comic Larry David were on the call sheet, as were four jugglers and five mimes. To the exhausted observers watching the auditions, It felt as if every vaudeville act and stand-up comedian between Boston and Washington, D.C. had shown up. Which is the way the show's 30-year-old creator, Lorne Michaels, wanted it. Over the previous 9 months, Michaels had traveled from Bangor to San Diego, watching hundreds of comedy club shows. He talked to writers from television and radio programs and every magazine with a humor page. His goal, he later said, was to see every single funny person in North America. By noon on the second day of auditions, tryouts were running late when a man burst through the doors, leapt onto the stage, and demanded the producer's attention. He had a trim mustache and wore a three-piece suit. He carried a folded umbrella and an attaché. "I've been waiting out there for 3 hours, and I'm not going to wait anymore," he shouted. "I'm going to miss my plane." He marched across the stage. "That's it. You've had your chance. Good day." Then he stormed out. "What the hell was that?" one producer asked. "Oh, that was just Danny Aykroyd," said Michaels. They had known each other in Toronto, where Aykroyd was a student in Michaels' improv class. "He's probably going to do the show," Michaels said. Over the next month, as Michaels chose the rest of the cast, the same thing happened again and again. Instead of picking from among the hundreds of people he auditioned, Michaels hired comedians he already knew or who had been recommended by friends. Michaels knew Aykroyd from Canada, and Aykroyd, in turn, was enthusiastic about a guy named John Belushi he had met in Chicago. Belushi initially said he'd never appear on television because it was a crass medium. But he recommended a castmate from the National Lampoon show named Gilda Radner, who Michaels, it turned out, had already hired. They knew each other from Godspell. The National Lampoon show was affiliated with National Lampoon magazine, which was founded by the writer Michael O'Donohue, who lived with another comedy writer named Ann Beats. All of these people created the first season of Saturday Night Live. Howard Shore, the show's music director, had gone to summer camp with Michaels. Neil Levy, the show's talent coordinator, was Michaels' cousin. Michaels had met Chevy Chase while standing in a line in Hollywood to see Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Tom Schiller, another writer, knew Michaels because they had gone to Joshua Tree to eat hallucinogenic mushrooms together. And Schiller's father, a Hollywood writer, had taken Michaels under his wing early in the young man's career. The original cast and writers of Saturday Night Live hailed largely from Canada, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and all moved to New York in 1975. "Manhattan was a show business wasteland then," said Marilyn Suzanne Miller, a writer whom Michaels hired after they collaborated on a Lily Tomlin special in L.A. "It was like Lorne had deposited us on Mars." When most of the staff got to New York, they didn't know anyone except one another. Many considered themselves anti-capitalist or anti-war activists, or at least they were fond of the recreational drugs these activists enjoyed, and now they were riding elevators with a bunch of suits at 30 Rockefeller Center, where the show's studio was being built. "We were all like 21 or 22 years old. We didn't have any money or any clue what we were doing. So we spent all of our time trying to make each other laugh," Schiller told me. "We'd eat every meal together. We'd go to the same bars each night. We were terrified that if we separated, one of us might get lost and never be heard from again." In subsequent years, as Saturday Night Live became one of the most popular and longest-running programs in television history, a kind of mythology emerged. In the early days of SNL, the journalist Malcolm Gladwell wrote in 2002, "Everyone knew everyone, and everyone was always in everyone else's business. And that fact goes a long way toward explaining the extraordinary chemistry among the show's cast. There are books filled with stories of John Belushi breaking into castmates' apartments to make spaghetti late at night, or setting their guest bedrooms on fire with carelessly handled joints, or writers gluing one another's furniture to the ceilings, or prank calling one another's offices, or ordering 30 pizzas to the news division and then dressing up like security guards so they could infiltrate the lower floors, steal the pizza, and leave the journalists with the bill. There are flowcharts detailing who from SNL slept with whom. They tend to get complicated because Michaels was married to writer Rosie Schuster, who eventually ended up with Dan Aykroyd, who had dated Gilda Radner, who everyone suspected was in love with writer Alan Zweibel, who later wrote a book explaining they were in love, but nothing ever happened. And besides, Radner later married a member of the SNL band. It was the 1970s, Miller told me. Sex was what you did. Saturday Night Live has been held up as a model of great team dynamics. It is cited in college textbooks as an example of what groups can achieve when the right conditions are in place and a team intensely bonds. The group that created Saturday Night Live came together so successfully, this theory goes, because a communal culture replaced individual needs. There were shared experiences. We were all the kids who didn't get to sit at the popular table in high school, Beats told me. Common social networks. Lorne was a cult leader, said writer Bruce McCall. As long as you had a Mooney-like devotion to the group, you were fine. And group needs trumped individual egos. I don't mean this in a bad way, but we were Guyana on the 17th floor, said Zweibel. It was a stalag. But this theory becomes considerably more complicated when you speak to the people on the original Saturday Night Live team. It's true those writers and actors spent enormous amounts of time together and developed a strong sense of unity, but not because of forced intimacy or shared history or because they particularly liked each other. In fact, the group norms at Saturday Night Live created as many tensions as strengths. There was a tremendous amount of competitiveness and infighting, said Beats. We were so young, and no one knew how to control themselves. We fought all the time. One night in the writer's room, Beats made a joke that they were lucky Hitler had killed 6 million Jews, because otherwise no one would have found an apartment in New York City. Marilyn Miller didn't speak to me for 2 weeks, she said. Marilyn was completely uptight about jokes about Hitler. I think she hated me at that point. We would glare at each other for hours. There were jealousies and rivalries, battles for Michaels' affection, competition for airtime. You wanted your sketch to go on, which meant someone else's would have to get cut, said Beats. If you were succeeding, someone else was failing. Even the closest relationships, such as between Alan Zweibel and Gilda Radner, were fraught. Gilda and I came up with this character, Rosanna Dana, and on Friday I would go into the office and stay up all night writing the script, like 8 or 9 pages, said Zweibel. Then Gilda would arrive mid-morning, totally refreshed, and take a red pen and start crossing shit out, like she was some kind of school marm, and I would get pissed. So I would go back to my office and rework everything, and she would do it again. By the time the show went on, we usually weren't speaking to each other. I once stopped writing sketches for her for 3 weeks. I purposely saved my best stuff for other people. Furthermore, it's not entirely true that members of the SNL team enjoyed spending time together. Garrett Morris, the show's only black actor, felt like an outcast and planned to quit as soon as he had enough money. Jane Curtin would escape to her home and husband as soon as the show was done for the week. People would form allegiances and then get into fights and then form counter-allegiances. Everyone was in these cliques that were constantly shifting, said Bruce McCall, who came aboard as a writer for the show's second season. It was a pretty dismal place. In some ways, it's remarkable the Saturday Night Live team gelled at all. Michaels, it turned out, had chosen everyone precisely because of their disparate tastes. Zweibel was a specialist in Borscht Belt one-liners. Michael O'Donohue wrote dark, bitter satires about such topics as the assassination of JFK. When a distraught secretary told O'Donohue that Elvis had died, he replied, "Smart career move." Tom Schiller aspired to direct art films, and everyone could become scathing critics when their sensibilities clashed. "Great, Garrett," O'Donohue once said when he read a script the actor had spent weeks writing. Then he dropped it into a trash can. "Real good." "Comedy writers carry a lot of anger," said Schiller. "We were vicious to each other. If you thought something was funny and no one else did, it could be brutal." So why, given all the tensions and infighting, did the Saturday Night Live creators become such an effective, productive team? The answer isn't that they spent so much time together, or that the show's norms put the needs of the group above individual egos. Rather, the SNL team clicked because, surprisingly, they all felt safe enough around one another to keep pitching new jokes and ideas. The writers and actors worked amid norms that made everyone feel like they could take risks and be honest with one another, even as they were shooting down ideas, undermining one another, and competing for airtime. "You know that saying, 'There's no I in team'?" Michaels told me. "My goal was the opposite of that. All I wanted were a bunch of I's. I wanted everyone to hear each other, but no one to disappear into the group." That's how psychological safety emerged. Imagine you have been invited to join one of two teams. Team A is composed of 8 men and 2 women, all of whom are exceptionally smart and successful. When you watch a video of them working together, you see articulate professionals who take turns speaking and are polite and courteous. At some point, when a question arises, one person, clearly an expert on the topic, speaks at length while everyone else listens. No one interrupts. When another person veers off topic, a colleague gently reminds him of the agenda and steers the conversation back on track. The team is efficient. The meeting ends exactly when scheduled. Team B is different. It's evenly divided among men and women, some of whom are successful executives, while others are middle managers with little in the way of professional achievements. On a video, you see teammates jumping in and out of a discussion haphazardly. Some ramble at length, others are curt. They interrupt one another so much, it's sometimes hard to follow the conversation. When a team member abruptly changes the topic or loses sight of their point, the rest of the group follows him off the agenda. At the end of the meeting doesn't actually end. Everyone sits around and gossips. Which group would you rather join? Before you decide, imagine you are given one additional piece of information. When both teams first formed, each member was asked to complete what's known as the reading the mind in the eyes test. They were each shown 36 photos of people's eyes and asked to choose which word, among 4 offered, best described the emotion that person was feeling. This test, you are told, measures people's empathy. The members of Team A picked the right emotion on average 49% of the time. Team B, 58%. Does that change your mind? In 2008, a group of psychologists from Carnegie Mellon and MIT wondered if they could figure out which kinds of teams were clearly superior. As research, management, and many other kinds of tasks are increasingly accomplished by groups, both those working face-to-face and virtually, it is becoming even more important to understand the determinants of group performance, the researchers wrote in the journal Science in 2010. Over the last century, psychologists made significant progress in defining and systematically measuring intelligence in individuals. We have used the statistical approach they developed for individual intelligence to systematically measure the intelligence of groups. Put differently, The researchers wanted to know if there is a collective intelligence that emerges within a team that is distinct from the smarts of any single member. To accomplish this, the researchers recruited 699 people, divided them into 152 teams, and gave each group a series of assignments that required different kinds of cooperation. Most teams began by spending 10 minutes brainstorming possible uses for a brick and received a point for each unique idea. Then they were asked to plan a shopping trip as if they were housemates sharing a single car. Each teammate was given a different list of groceries to buy and a map showing prices at various stores. The only way to maximize the team's score was for each person to sacrifice one item they really wanted in exchange for something that pleased the entire group. Then the teams were told to arrive at a ruling on a disciplinary case in which a college basketball player allegedly bribed his teacher. Some teammates represented the interests of the faculty. Others were stand-ins for the athletics department. Points were awarded for reaching a verdict that maximized each group's concerns. Each of these tasks required full team participation. Each demanded different kinds of collaboration. As the researchers observed groups going about the tasks, they saw various dynamics emerge. Some teams came up with dozens of clever uses for the brick, arrived at a verdict that made everyone happy, and easily divvied up the shopping trip. Others kept describing the same uses for the brick in different words, came to verdicts that left some participants feeling alienated, and managed to buy only ice cream and Fruit Loops because no one was willing to compromise. What was interesting was that teams that did well on one assignment also seemed to do well on the others. Conversely, teams that failed at one thing seemed to fail at everything. Some might have hypothesized that the good teams were successful because their members were smarter, that group intelligence might be nothing more than the intelligence of the individuals making up the team. But the researchers had tested participants' IQs beforehand and found that individual intelligence didn't correlate with team performance. Putting 10 smart people in a room didn't mean they solved problems more intelligently. In fact, those smart people were often outperformed by groups consisting of people who had scored lower on intellect tests, but who still seemed smarter as a group. Others might have argued that the good teams had more decisive leaders, but the research showed that wasn't right either. The researchers eventually concluded that the good teams had succeeded not because of innate qualities of team members, but because of how they treated one another. Put differently, the most successful teams had norms that caused everyone to mesh particularly well. We find converging evidence of a general collective intelligence factor that explains a group's performance on a wide variety of tasks, the researchers wrote in their science article. This kind of collective intelligence is a property of the group itself, not just the individuals in it. It was the norms, not the people, that made teams so smart. The right norms could raise the collective intelligence of mediocre thinkers. The wrong norms could hobble a group made up of people who, on their own, were all exceptionally bright. But when the researchers reviewed videos of the good team's interactions, they noticed that not all norms looked alike. It was striking how different some of them behaved, said Anita Woolley, the study's lead author. Some teams had a bunch of smart people who figured out how to break up work evenly. Other groups had pretty average members, but came up with ways to take advantage of everyone's relative strengths. Some groups had one strong leader. Others were more fluid, and everyone took a leadership role. There were, however, two behaviors that all the good teams shared. First, all the members of the good team spoke in roughly the same proportion, a phenomenon the researchers referred to as equality in distribution of conversational turn-taking. In some teams, for instance, Everyone spoke during each task. In other groups, conversation ebbed from assignment to assignment, but by the end of the day, everyone had spoken roughly the same amount. As long as everyone got a chance to talk, the team did well, said Woolley. But if only one person or a small group spoke all the time, the collective intelligence declined. The conversations didn't need to be equal every minute, but in aggregate, they had to balance out. Second, the good teams tested as having high average social sensitivity, a fancy way of saying that the groups were skilled at intuiting how members felt based on their tone of voice, how people held themselves, and the expressions on their faces. One of the easiest ways to gauge social sensitivity is to show someone photos of people's eyes and ask them to describe what that person is thinking or feeling, the empathy test described previously. This is a test of how well the participant can put themselves into the mind of the other person and tune in to their mental state, wrote the creator of the Reading the Mind in the Eyes test, Simon Baron Cohen of the University of Cambridge. While men, on average, correctly guess the emotion of the person in the photo only 52% of the time, women typically guess right 61%. People on the good teams in Woolley's experiment scored above average on the Reading the Mind in the Eyes test. They seemed to know when someone was feeling upset or left out. They spent time asking one another what they were thinking about. The good teams also contained more women. Coming back to the question of which team to join, if you are given a choice between the serious-minded professional Team A or the free-flowing, more informal Team B, you should opt for Team B. Team A is smart and filled with effective colleagues. As individuals, they will all be successful. But as a team, they still tend to act like individuals. There's little to suggest that as a group, they become collectively intelligent, because there's little evidence that everyone has an equal voice and that members are sensitive to teammates' emotions and needs. In contrast, Team B is messier. People speak over one another. They go on tangents. They socialize instead of remaining focused on the agenda. Everyone speaks as much as they need to, though. They feel equally heard and are attuned to one another's body language and expressions. They try to anticipate how one another will react. Team B may not contain as many individual stars, but when that group unites, the sum is much greater than any of its parts.